Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Richard Dieter, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center, who examines the findings of a Justice Department study which found significant racial and geographic disparity in the application of the federal death penalty. Soren Ambrose, with the 50 Years is Enough Network, who previews the demonstrations being organized to greet the World Bank and International Monetary Fund on September 26th as they gather in Prague for their annual meeting. And Susan Alsner of Earth Challenge, who describes the goals of her group's Shifting Gears Bicycle Ride for Environmental Action, which will travel from Norwich, Connecticut to Atlanta, Georgia during September. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
From May 30th to June 4th, three members of the Black Caucus, Chairman James Clyburn of South Carolina, Representative Benny Thompson of Mississippi, and Gregory Meeks from Queens, went to Cuba on a second official caucus delegation. There they visited many healthcare facilities and familiarized themselves with the Cuban medical system. On their last night, they had a lengthy meeting with Cuban President Fidel Castro. Representative Thompson told Castro he was impressed with what he saw and asked the Cuban leader if he was aware that people were medically underserved in impoverished areas of the United States. Castro immediately responded by saying he would be glad to send Cuban doctors to America, but thought that would bring political repercussions. He followed by offering 500 scholarships to the economically underprivileged in the U.S., specifically 250 to African Americans and 250 to Hispanics, Native Americans, and others. Their only requirement would be to return to their hometown to administer medical care. In June, Carlos Dotres, a Cuban official, met with Caucus Chair James Clyburn at the U.S. Interest Section in Havana about extending Castro's offer to all of the Black Caucus districts. For the first time in history, the caucus invited the Cubans to their annual congressional conference held recently. Castro again mentioned the offer when he spoke at the Riverside Church in Harlem on September 8th, while in New York for the United Nations Millennium Summit. The Cuban government has formally extended the offer, and the Clinton administration has yet to respond. In mid-September, Russian nuclear dissident Alexander Nikitin appeared before the Presidium, a select group of the Russian Supreme Court who last spring upheld his acquittal on treason charges. The Russian intelligence agency, the Federal Security Service, or FSB, first arrested Nikitin in 1996 after he co-authored a report with a Norwegian environmental group documenting abuses by the Russian Northern Fleet, including dumping nuclear reactors and radioactive waste in the Arctic Ocean. In the aftermath of the sinking of the Russian submarine Kursk, many Russian human rights monitors were alarmed that Russian intelligence leaders were pushing to reopen the case against Nikitin. Alexei Simonon of the Glasnost Foundation told the Christian Science Monitor that one of the hallmarks of the Putin era so far has been the extreme irritation with any independent stirrings in the courts, media, or body politic. Former Russian naval officer Grigory Pasko was sent to prison for 20 years on charges of treason for giving evidence of the Russian Navy dumping nuclear material in the Pacific Ocean to foreign reporters. Eco-activists and human rights monitors who had been closely watching the hearing were relieved when the Russian Presidium refused to reopen the case. Environmental lawyer Jan Gosla observed that if the case weren't reopened, it would be a unique chance to send the past practices of the Russian courts back to the scrap heap of history. Breast cancer survivor Hope Nimeroff thought she was on the right track. After having a small tumor removed in 1995, she went on a vegetarian diet and started walking and doing yoga. Most of all, Nimeroff, a New York breast cancer activist, drank lots of green tea. But she was startled after a blood test showed her blood had trace levels of DDT, which some experts say can lead to breast cancer. A further lab test showed that the DDT came from the green tea that she was drinking. According to the news magazine In These Times, this is far from an isolated case. A test of green tea sold in the New York metro area showed a number of brands violated federal safety standards. Several brands tested were contaminated with chlorpyrifos, which the Environmental Protection Agency banned in June due to potential health threats to children. Green tea is grown and DDT is used in both China and India, where much of the imports coming into the U.S. originate. EPA pesticide expert Janice Jensen says DDT is caught in the atmosphere and can be redeposited far from its use site. That's one of the best arguments for the Global Treaty on Persistent Organic Pollutants. Still, there were only trace levels of DDT found in the non-organic green tea tested. But Dr. Jeanette Sherman, author of Life's Delicate Balance, Causes and Prevention of Breast Cancer, states there is no safe exposure of women to DDT. Environmental activists believe the DDT contamination is just part of a much larger crisis, the poisoning of the world food supply by dangerous pesticides. Today, 3% of all food tested coming from foreign nations contains outlawed pesticides. Much of it eventually reaches supermarket shelves. Jay Feldman of the National Coalition Against the Misuse of Pesticides says it is very difficult to stop contaminated food once it has reached the United States. The only real solution is for food import companies to adopt tougher food quality standards. This week's news summary was compiled by Denise Manzari and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Last week, the Justice Department released the findings of a comprehensive study which examined the application of the federal death penalty. The review found significant racial and geographical disparities, provoking Attorney General Janet Reno to say that she was sorely troubled by the findings. According to the study, in 75% of the cases where United States attorneys recommended the death penalty since 1985, the defendant was a person of color. Although the federal government has not executed anyone since 1963, there are now 21 inmates on death row facing capital punishment, two-thirds of them black or Latino. Earlier this year, Senator Russ Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, called for a suspension of all federal executions. Senator Feingold, along with Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. of Illinois, proposed legislation in April to impose a national death penalty moratorium. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Richard Dieter, executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, who examines the findings of the Justice Department's study and where the fight to abolish the death penalty is going in this election year.
Well, it was expected that when the federal government had the death penalty, it would be done in a more rationally and racially fair way than is often seen on the state level. However, the results, that is, the people on death row, were not turning out that way. The death row, the federal death row, is more racially disproportionate than the state's death row. And so that was the initial concern and prompted a study. Well, perhaps the problem existed somewhere else. But it turns out that the cases coming into the system are, that is, the cases being recommended by the local U.S. attorneys around the country, and the cases approved by the Attorney General for prosecution, all have this high 75% to 80% of minorities under their the prosecution. The federal government looked at over 600 potential federal death penalty cases, and this problem is occurring across the board. And there's a second problem as well. Not only is it racially disproportionate, but it seems to be skewed in geographically. About five of the 94 federal districts are responsible for about 40% of all the cases. Many of the districts have no death penalty cases. And what this says is simply not that there's no crimes in these other districts or that all the crime is occurring in these few, but rather that the death penalty is inevitably arbitrary. It's up to individual discretion and choices that have little to do with the crime and a lot to do with the person making the decision. And so when it comes out racially biased or racially at least disproportionate, and geographically unpredictable, one has to wonder whether you have a fair system.
Well, from your experience and doing a lot of detailed studies of the death penalty and its application across the country, Richard Dieter, where do you think the bias is coming from?
Well, there's a lot of individual decision makers in this process, and all of them come into this system with predispositions. I think there's an underlying racism in this country. It's part of our history. It's part of our makeup. It's part of all of us. We see things differently when it comes to color, despite our best intentions not to do so. And you know, it's interesting, for example, looking at not just federal prosecutors, but all the prosecutors responsible for death penalty cases. 98% of the prosecutors who make the death penalty decisions in this country are white. It's just incredible. I mean, nobody sees this. This is one of those absent things. If this were IBM, there would be a suit. If it were in some other area more subject to public scrutiny. But the 98% of the prosecutors making death penalty decisions are white in this country is unbelievable, but true. 1% are African American, 1% are Hispanic.
Richard Dieter, as you were saying, what's critical in all this is public opinion and the courageousness or lack thereof of the politicians on this issue. And I think we all remember back in 1992 when then Arkansas Governor Clinton went back to his home state during the election campaign to execute a man who was partially brain damaged, who had even put some dessert under his bed, thinking he was coming back from the execution chamber. How much has changed since 1992, do you think, in terms of the politics of this issue, where we can really see some changes?
I think some have commented that the public is out ahead of the politicians, often and in particular on this issue. Many politicians, like presidential candidates, came into office at a time when support for the death penalty was almost required. It's rare that a new candidate would be opposed to the death penalty. We're now, I think, at a different point. In Congress now is a bill called the Innocence Protection Act. There's another bill to impose a moratorium on the federal death penalty and another one on the states, a national moratorium altogether. In some states, like Illinois, they already have a moratorium. New Hampshire voted to abolish the death penalty, vetoed by the governor. But nevertheless, the legislatures right now are looking for ways to reform the death penalty, if not get rid of it completely. So I think America in the 21st century is beginning to address a human rights issue that has, in some countries, already been addressed, and certainly by the leading countries in human rights field, it has been abolished. I think the U.S. Will join that and will eventually be proud of the fact that it did.
That was Richard Dieter, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. You can contact the center by calling area code 202-293-6970 or visit their website at www.deathpenaltyinfo.org. Economists and representatives of hundreds of nations will be gathering in Prague for the annual meeting of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund September 21st through the 28th. But those traveling to this year's summit in the Czech Republic are bracing for major demonstrations against the policies of the financial institution founded shortly after World War II. The actions in Prague follow major demonstrations against the World Trade Organization in Seattle last winter and an earlier mass protest against the World Bank in Washington, D.C. in April. In addition to legal protest and nonviolent civil disobedience, organizers are planning a counter-summit on development policy, numerous workshops, and a cultural festival. While more than 10,000 police are being deployed in Prague to prevent disruption of the event, Czech President Václav Havel, who has himself leveled criticism at the World Bank, has arranged to meet protest leaders at the presidential palace. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Soren Ambrose, policy analyst with the 50 Years Is Enough Network, who discusses the World Bank IMF policies that have provoked growing criticism and the new coalitions that have targeted the bank in Prague and elsewhere.
The structural adjustment programs that have been imposed for some 20 years by the IMF in the lead and also by the World Bank more and more, to the point where over half of the World Bank's loans now have structural adjustment conditions attached. And those conditions are basically the neoliberal formula, the free trade market reform formula, where they have countries lay off employees and reorient their economies for export production, build sweatshops, allow in multinational corporations, and not coincidentally reduce subsidies and health and education spending for the most vulnerable people in their population. So it's been a formula for disaster for countries that were already, in many cases, on the brink. So people have been very upset about structural adjustment programs for a long time, and now with increased attention in the North, in North America and in Europe, to the effects of the WTO and getting a wider view of what's happening in the rest of the world, attention has turned more and more to the World Bank and the IMF.
Why don't you tell us how the coalition of groups have grown since the massive demonstrations in Seattle last winter against the World Trade Organization?
Well, we've seen increasing participation from folks in the U.S. who haven't previously been focused on international issues, people who are concerned about things like welfare reform, seeing the commonalities between the situation that they have in the U.S. and, because of the publicity that we've gotten with Seattle and the events in Washington, the same kinds of economic circumstances growing out of the same economic corporate globalization agenda that have been imposed on people in the southern countries. And probably the biggest news of the way that the coalition has grown in the United States in particular is that the labor unions have increasingly come on board. Of course, Seattle was notable not quite a year ago with the WTO meetings for having a combination of direct action activists in the streets, along with a more conventional labor union rally and march. It was the combination of those two things that made Seattle so noteworthy, both in terms of its size and the diversity of the crowd that was there. There was a lot of skepticism at the time of Seattle that, you know, this coalition won't stick together. And in fact, just a few months ago, despite the fact that we did stick together for the April 16th actions in Washington, there was an article announcing that the coalition that had come together for Seattle was fizzling out. Well, I think what we're going to see in September with the actions not only in Prague, but the many actions going on in the United States in solidarity. Most people in the United States who are interested in these issues, who were active in these demonstrations, who are reaching out to new constituencies, are foregoing the trip to Prague in order to organized in their own communities. So there are actions in 57 cities in the United States, most of them with a strong labor component.
And what can we expect to happen in Prague during the demonstrations there? I know that the Czech Republic's police force are on alert. There are thousands of police expected to be guarding against the demonstrators and whatever their plans are. Is the goal to shut down the meeting as it was in Seattle?
The official word that I'm seeing on the various internet communications is that they are not calling for a shutdown. I think this is a very deliberate and I think probably very wise choice on the part of the Prague organizers, partially because of the disposition of the Czech authorities, which, as I saw when I was there for a planning session back at the end of April, I stayed for May Day, and the Czech police, as bad as the ones that we saw in Philadelphia and Los Angeles this summer, the Czech police really don't stand on niceties at all. And there was some concern about, while the Czech organizers are used to dealing with this kind of problem, there was concern about inviting people from southern countries from various backgrounds around the world to Prague and then having a melee. But there will be a vigorous protest in the streets.
Now, I wonder, in terms of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, obviously, as you said before, they've come in for a lot of scrutiny they hadn't had before. Have they at all given any ground? I just read, as I'm sure you did, that they're expected to sign some documents in Prague that would offer debt relief to some of the poorest nations in the world. Maybe you could tell us your assessment of that, and do you think that's a result of the pressure that's being applied now by groups all over the world?
Well, Scott, I'm certain that it is a result of the pressure mounted over the last several years by the Jubilee 2000 campaign, over a longer period by DEC campaigners, including the 50 Years is Enough Network, and specifically over the last year by the campaigns that have been going on in Seattle and Washington. But the problem is that what they're offering is not anything more than rhetoric. It's just a matter of them offering another much vaunted improvement to programs that are really so flawed as to be worthless. And as the article in the New York Times quite startlingly revealed, officials at the Treasury Department themselves are saying that this is window dressing to try to suck the air out of the demonstrations in Prague.
That was Soren Ambrose, policy analyst with the 50 Years is Enough Network. You can contact the network by calling area code 202-IMF-BANK or visit their website at www.50years.org. The organization Earth Challenge was founded last year by two women whose goal is to help others learn firsthand about some of the nation's serious environmental issues and to meet people who are dealing with the fallout. They do it by organizing long-distance bicycle rides that stop in communities where local environmental struggles are underway. Last year, they rode from Georgia to Nevada to expose the dangers of nuclear energy. This year, Susan Alsner of New Haven, Connecticut, and her partner Lee Little of Decatur, Georgia, have organized a project called Shifting Gears, Ride for Environmental Action 2000. During September, Alsner, Little, and four other women are riding from Norwich, Connecticut, to Atlanta. They're focusing on environmental problems caused by unsustainable energy sources, such as oil, coal, and nuclear. The bike riders will stop in places like Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the site of the 1979 Three Mile Island nuclear plant accident, West Virginia, where mountaintop removal coal mining has devastated many communities, and Barnwell, South Carolina, home of a radioactive waste dump. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Susan Alsner, who explains what the group's bike tour hopes to accomplish.
The original inspiration came from these visits to struggling communities. What we wanted to do was take more individuals to places like this so that they could experience firsthand the reality of these dire health consequences. And then, much in the same way as we felt moved to do more about it, we were hoping that our teams would feel moved to become more committed to these, working to correct these problems. And at the same time, what our project does is it really boosts the morale of people who are working locally, often in really small, I guess to a certain extent, isolated groups. And it's hard to do this work, and it's great when people can get together and, you know, share creative ideas and even frustrations to help each other keep going.
Are people joining you along the way for parts of the ride as you ride through these various places?
Oh yeah, definitely. In towns like Peekskill, New York, and Washington, D.C., people are with us for legs into the city and out of the city. You know, they'll just join us for like 10 miles or so.
You said you wanted to raise awareness, but are there any specific issues that you really hope to have an impact on by doing this ride and stopping at these different places?
Well, specifically, we're really trying to promote sustainable energy options. We've worked in the past only complaining about problems like nuclear waste transportation and nuclear reactor facilities and nuclear waste dumps. But you only get so far with that, and this time we wanted to come out and look at the problems, but really as the main goal for this ride, we want to impress upon people that sustainable energy is a very viable option these days. And in Connecticut, we're really lucky because there's an organization called the Connecticut Energy Co-op, which has put together a package of 100% renewable energy sources for the electric consumer. You can buy your electricity through the Connecticut Energy Co-op. It's 100% green, and it's only 1 cent more per kilowatt hour, which ends up being about an average of $5 a month for a home. is non-nuclear, non-coal, non-oil. It's called EcoWatt. That's the name of the product. And it's amazing. These citizens got together and researched this and formed a co-op. So if you do join on with them, you're actually can be part of the decision-making process, too. It's a fascinating organization. And so they, to me, really embody hope for a sustainable future. And that's we're just really lucky here that they had the gumption to go ahead and do that for us.
I know this is not the first ride you've done. You did an earlier ride. Can you talk about that a little bit? Who you hooked up with as partners in that ride and maybe what you accomplished from that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and last year, last summer, June and July, we rode from Atlanta, Georgia to Yucca Mountain, Nevada. And especially out west, we were really concerned about the effects of the nuclear fuel cycle on the health of communities. And from beginning to end of this cycle, there are very horrible consequences. And beginning with uranium mining, for example, in northwest New Mexico, we visited the Navajo. There are companies who want to install new uranium mines on their land, despite the fact that there are 1,000 open-pit uranium mines there that have been unremediated, you know, that were started in the 50s and have, I mean, the government is paying compensation to these people because they recognize how damaged their health has been. And then they want to go in and put new mines? That's ridiculous. Then we visited the Havasupai. They live in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. We spent a week there, and we actually raised them $15,500 to use to fight the installation of new uranium mines there as well. We went on to Yucca Mountain. That was the finish of the ride, which is the proposed National Nuclear Waste Storage Facility. The route all the way from Atlanta to Yucca Mountain traced the nuclear waste transportation system, rail and road. The proposed one would be transported by truck and train for at least the next 30 years, 77,000 metric tons of high-level nuclear waste from our nation's nuclear reactors. All this waste would be traveling through major cities, our towns on our highways. What are we going to do with this? We don't have a solution. It's outrageous. And the answer is to stop generating it right now, close these plants, and store it above ground on site where it can be monitored. They want to stick it in a mountain and never look at it again.
That was Susan Alsner of Earth Challenge. To contact the group, call area code 203-421-8355. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Tok. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.